Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Since June, a protest movement in Iran has caught the attention of the world, not just through the usual media, but via social media, cell phones and Twitter and YouTube. These efforts have turned the conflicts into something much more personal for the rest of us, with a much different feel than the iconic crowd at the American Embassy gates of 1979 and the faraway protest efforts by students in 1999. But do these changing methods of communication with the outside world change the bottom line? That's what I want to talk about today. Joining us today in the studio are three people who perhaps can shed some light on the current protest movement in Iran and how it compares and or contrasts with those in the past. Sohrab Behdad, he's professor of economics at Denison University, and you are from Iran.
Yes.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
And Richard Davis, he is chair of the Near Eastern Language and Cultures at Ohio State University. Professor Davis, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for asking me.
And also Bahram, he is an OSU student. You're from Iran.
Yep.
And I appreciate you being here. We're not using Bahram's real name because we want to protect his identity and keep him very safe while he's in Ohio, at least.
You
are welcome. In mid-December, there was a statement put out by Trita Parsi. He's the president of the National Iranian American Council and adjunct scholar for the Middle East Institute, which he helped found. He told the Congressional Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs that the protests in Iran since June are nothing short of a tectonic shift, that never before have people poured out into the streets in such numbers demanding that their votes and rights be respected. And I was wondering, is tectonic too strong, or is it too weak, or is it just right? Sohrab?
It is a very deep movement. It's widespread. Now, if that means tectonic, it is. People have been relatively subdued over the last 30 years. There has been some major, complaints that people have in many aspects of their life, quite a lot social, cultural, and also economic. So they, when the election, actually it's very interesting that they were very quiet before the election because they were not all that excited about the candidates because all the candidates were previous members of the regime. But during debate process, which was very unusual in Iranian politics, the candidates, and particularly Ahmadinejad, started attacking very strongly and personally the other three candidates, and particularly two, Mousavi and Karoubi. And that brought a new face to Mousavi and Karoubi, which people didn't expect, and energized people, and they came into the election. And when the election turned out as it did, and they all perceived that there was a faulty election, then they came out in the street and they sort of reflected the disappointment that they have had with the regime and the anger that they had, and particularly the young, and particularly among the young, the women. And as you see in the pictures, women are in front of most of the protests.
Yes, they are. Where were you in 1979?
I was in Iran. I was a member of Faculty of Economics of Tehran University, and Tehran University was one of the major centers of the protests, to the extent that the football or the soccer field of Tehran University was as the place that every group wanted to express its hegemonic power by having it. And the first the prime minister of the provisional revolutionary government gave his talk in that soccer field. And now that soccer field is every Friday. It's no longer a soccer field. It's in the middle of the Tehran University, and it is the place of Friday players.
Now, this is something that we never saw in 79. This, you know, we didn't see that part of the protest back then. All we saw, as we were talking about it earlier, were the protesters in front of the wrought iron gates, which is what I remember. I may be wrong, at the U.S. Embassy. Was that obvious, you know, when you were in Iran at the time, were you aware of what the images were that were being, that were being seen around the world?
No, it was not as easy as it is today because there was no satellite television, etc. We could see only through some radios like BBC Radio and others, but the images never came to us.
And Professor Davis, where were you in 1979?
In 1979, I had just left Iran. Okay. I was living in Iran from 70 to 78. It became clear at the end of 78 that it was tricky to stay. And my wife and I decided to leave. But I was following what was going on very closely because I had many friends in Iran. My wife's family were in Iran. So I felt very emotionally caught up and involved in it.
So when you were watching the same images that the rest of us were on television, you knew there was a lot more to that.
Yes, I was aware of the background. And I was also very aware in 79 of how inadequate the coverage was in the West. I'm not blaming anybody. It was very difficult to get news. But when you've been in a country that's going through great turmoil and then you see events like that reported from outside, you realize that all the nuance, the depth, the complication, the personal stories usually are lost. That's changed a bit this time because of things like cell phone images being sent around the world. And so you do get these human moments. Which we didn't in 1979, or not nearly so much. But even so, the kind of the real reality of being caught up in something like that is not apparent from the outside, no matter how many images one sees.
Oh, Bahram, I have a feeling that you weren't even born in 1979.
Yeah, you're right.
Right. How old are you?
It's about 26.
26, yep. Mid-20s. What did you know of that time?
I saw a lot of actually movie and kind of actually video, a lot of newspaper about that and some kind of movement, political or from just general people before revolution and some kind of problem and some kind of issue after revolution. And difference, the claim and demand of people before and after that, and some kind of problem that people or my friends or my professors think that this is a main reason of revolution. They thought that because I was not there. And just because I somehow talk and had a kind of close connection between some people were there. In before revolution, after revolution, in wartime, and this kind of stuff.
So what's happening now, we were talking about earlier, I became entranced on Twitter the other day. I just kept going from Twitter image to Twitter image. Of course, it's mostly through YouTube, and it's mostly through people's cell phones. And does it seem like a familiar sight to you when you're looking at this? I imagine you're looking at the same stuff I've been.
I had a bad feeling about people who did some kind of revolution in 1979. Mm-hmm. So this is a big question in my mind. Okay, why they are interested in a kind of revolution? They can't have a kind of correction in the fundamental part of government and talking and negotiate and keep moving their idea until they, for example, they catch their goal. Why they go to a revolution? Because this kind of stuff destroy everything and you want to build up again. But in these days, when I see my people, my friends, my classmates, and other part of Iran, they move and they want to. It's a kind of tangible for me, the movement of 79. Now it makes sense more for me why they are interested in some kind of movement and revolution in 79.
You know, back then, a lot of folks in the United States were confused, just everyday folks, you know, probably not you, Professor Davis, but about who was fighting the Shah of Iran at the time and who opposed him. And a lot of folks didn't understand that there were the very religious aspect to it and then the secular aspect as well. And the folks that I met when I was at Arizona State University at the time, it was a secular opposition. And they were concerned at that time and trying to explain the difference and that this isn't going to end up the way you think. It's not going to be what you think it is because it's not just one group. And it's the same way now, isn't it?
Okay. I think there is some misconception among even the scholars about the Iranian Revolution, They keep calling it Islamic Revolution, mm-hmm. as it was a revolution for Islam. Actually, it was a revolution. It was a democratic revolution. People wanted democracy. People wanted to have more say in their life. And the regime of the Shah did not provide that. So it was a revolution, a popular revolution, democratic revolution, which ended with the Islamic government. So the revolution itself was not Islamic. However, once the Islamic regime was established, there were a whole lot of people who were not agreeing with the essence of having Islamic state. And there was debate. There was a whole lot of debate in Iran at that time, to the point that there were even naming of the country, that is the government, which should be, what should be called, Democratic Republic of Iran, Republic of Iran, etc. And Khomeini came out and said, it is Islamic Republic of Iran, not a word more, not a word less. So this ended the discussion at that point, because there was this whole large wave of popular support for Khomeini one way or another. But that did not mean that everybody consented to the having Islamic state. Even among the clergy, some of the clergy did not. Actually, most of the sources of imitation, the high-ranking clergy in Iran, did not want to have the form of a state which is Islamic as a ruling administration of the state.
We're going to take a short break right now. But first, I wanted to hear an audio cut from the street protest in Iran on December 27th, just this past December 27th. It's in a report from Al Jazeera.
Violence on the streets of Tehran. Protesters in the center of the city filmed carrying a body, chanting, "We will kill the person who killed our brother." Al Jazeera cannot verify when or where this video was taken. Sunday's clashes come on the Ashura, one of the most important events in Iran's religious calendar, as well as the traditional seventh day of mourning for the late cleric Montazeri. Protesters have vowed to continue their rallying into the night. Rosalind Jordan, Al Jazeera.
Okay, and this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to take a quick break. If you have a question or comment for our guest, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. And at noon, Fresh Air will be here. On Fresh Air today, many musicians and music fans are mourning the death of songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut. He died Christmas Day at the age of 45. We'll hear from a guitarist who collaborated with him on two records, and from Michael Stripe of REM, who produced his first two albums. All that and much more on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. A winter weather advisory in effect until 6 o'clock Friday morning. Light snow developing currently in central Ohio. A snow accumulation this afternoon of 2 to 4 inches and a high of 25 degrees. More snow tonight, another 1 to 2 inches of snow, giving us a total snow accumulation for the day of 3 to 5 inches. A low tonight of 17. And then cloudy with a slight chance of a few snow flurries on Friday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the protests in Iran right now. They may not be going on right now, but they have been going on for about the last 6 months since the disputed June elections. They triggered the protests in the first place. Nothing on that score has changed, however, except perhaps more friction and infighting between the insiders of the regime. Again, there's insider fighting on this. It's not a homogeneous type of situation. Richard Davis, OSU professor of Near Eastern Studies, and what is the difference? Why are people confused about what's really going on over there when they talk about a revolution in Iran?
Well, the revolution in Iran at the moment is very different from the revolution in 1979. One of the things that was very important in 1979 was a very strong anti-Western, anti-foreign feeling. And one of the reasons for the 1979 revolution was the feeling that Iran's government was completely in the hands of the West. And the Shah was seen as a Western puppet. Whether this is true or not, it was the perception. It's not an anti-foreign movement at all in Iran at the moment. It is anti-particular people within the regime in particular, and among some of the protesters, particular principles by which the Islamic Republic was laid down. So there's a quite different feeling to the revolution, revolution's the wrong word, to the protest movement that's going on at the moment. There's a huge news blackout in Iran, which is one of the reasons that it's so confused as to what actually is happening.
Within the country.
Within the country. Right. Within the country. And also it's very difficult for people outside to know what's going on except by these cell phone images and so forth. Being a reporter in Iran is very dangerous at the moment, and Western reporters have been arrested as well as Iranian reporters. So there is a confusion, a real confusion as to actually what's happening. This is exacerbated by the fact that the leaders or the people who have emerged as the leaders of the protest movement have been fairly passive. They haven't actually directed people to do very much. And there is a feeling that the protest movement is very strong. It's strong in the sense that there is a great deal of passion in those who are involved with it, and I really think it's true that people are prepared to die, which can mean huge changes in the government when the people against the government are actually prepared to die for their beliefs. But it's very unfocused still. There isn't a leader who is emerging who would be an obvious replacement for the present government. This is one of the reasons why I feel that the predictions of the fall of the Islamic Republic, which have been appearing in the West for some time now, are very premature. I really think the Islamic Republic is likely to hang on in some form or other for a very long time.
You just were listening to Richard Davis. He is the OSU professor and chair of the Near Eastern Language and Cultures. And also in the studio, Sohrab Behdad. He is a professor of economics at Denison University. He is from Iran. And also Bahram, he is an OSU student from Iran. And thanks, everybody, again, for being with us today. They mentioned in that audio cut we just listened to that they cannot verify where this video is taken. Mm-hmm. And certainly from my perspective, I have not the foggiest idea where they're coming from. I look at them and I see a lot of chaos and cacophony, a lot of crazy noises. You don't know where they're coming from. Professor Behdad, do you know, I mean, when you're looking at those videos, is it obvious where, or are you as much in the dark as the rest of us?
Well, when you look at the videos or pictures,
from the cell phones mostly.
Yes, you can recognize that what city they are, or approximately what city they are. They're generally in the larger cities for one reason, that in the larger cities people feel less of a threat because the group is larger and identity is not as revealed, as easily revealed. As in the smaller towns, but there has been some similar demonstrations in smaller towns. I would like to add to this, something to what Dr. Davis said.
Okay.
And it is true that much of the demonstrations are spontaneous. They are not necessarily called with a particular agenda by the so-called leaders of the opposition. There are people who connect with each other through cell phones, through Twitters, and they call out. But their demand is pretty clear, and there are two levels of these demands. One level by the opposition leaders, they are within the limit what they call the red lines of the regime, and they cannot directly say that they are in opposition to the supreme leader. They cannot say it because if they do, they would become, direct opponents of the Islamic regime. But the people clearly do say that, and they have gone beyond the declarations of the so-called leaders, and they the slogans are death to the dictator. In the beginning, it was not mention of the dictator's name, but everybody knew who it was. And then later on, it became even his own name, Khamenei, that was the declaration of death to him. And the whole point is doing away with the dictatorial rule of the jurist. So that is where what the supreme leader's position is. He's a commander in chief and is a holder of many instruments of power within the regime. So whatever he wants, it gets done. So that is the debate. Now, there is a misconception again in the West. They refer to it as the rule of the mullahs. It is not. Now, there is a big fracture in the regime, within the regime, and nearly every independent clergy and major sources of imitation, they are in opposition, with the exception of probably one or two, they are in opposition to the existing rule. So what we have is essentially the supreme leader plus the military and the coercive forces like the Basij and Revolutionary Guard and the supreme leader versus almost everybody else, yes, and that is the confrontation that is taking place. But it is not an easy confrontation because it's a sort of a two powers against each other, and the military is not going to give up, and they are going to fight it. And the people on the other side don't seem to have given up, so we don't know what the outcome is going to be.
There's been the internal blackout, news blackout, but they are telling people that it's not them, that it's other groups from the outside coming in, that they don't use guns. They're not using guns against their own mm-hmm. people, that it must be somebody else that's doing this and they're causing the problem. When you're hearing from home, is that what you're hearing?
Actually, I want to first actually mention something, that having gun and using gun in my country is not that easy. The gun is just used in military and or kind of governmental. You cannot go out and buy gun.
There's gun
easy.
Control
exactly.
in Iran, in other words. Okay.
Okay. And so when they use kind of actually non very, very famous or very obvious clothes and some people using gun, there is obvious that where is the source of gun. So they use somehow other people with other clothes. But normally it's obvious and it's easy to people that who is these people and who control these peoples. This is not actually very, very difficult to demonstrate, and this is obvious to every people that just government and
they're not falling for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're seeing the same YouTube videos. Are you hearing from folks back home as it
yep,
is?
Yeah.
Yep. And
same thing. Because this, if you see that, the good thing about these actually movement, that you see this source of the YouTube is taken by not professional actually cameramen. Is it just people?
Yes, you can't those are
see,
definitely
yeah,
not professionals.
You can't see the voice. You can't see even, I do agree with Professor Behzad that I can even actually in Tehran or I'm telling you about Tehran. Mm-hmm. I can recognize some kind of a street even. What's happened, for example, in Boulevard Keshavarz, in Enghelab Square and this kind of stuff. I can see the same statues I was there in just
right.
three, less than 4 years ago. So this is a big difference between these. And you can see a lot of picture and movement that it's so, so peaceful. There are some people who control or take these opposition, they just use some part of constitution mm-hmm. that let people to move peacefully. This is a part of even Islamic Republic of Iran constitution. We can move, if we have some kind of objection to some kind of decision, we can move peacefully. And this is the main difference. So we don't violate any kind of rules they have, but they cannot tolerate that. We don't use any.
Which is why they're saying somebody else is doing the shooting. We're not doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah. But who should? the people has gun. So the gun controlled by government. It's obvious, the source of shooting.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. We're talking about the protests in Iran. We were talking earlier that this is not an anti-West movement like it was back in 1979. On the contrary, folks are looking to Washington for support in this case. And as far as I can see, they're saying this is not good in Washington. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, they don't like it. But I don't know much more. I can't see much more force in it than that. Professor Davis?
When you say they're looking to Washington for support, I think the West, and I'm not the only person who thinks this, has to be extremely careful in expressing support for the opposition movement, because it plays straight into the hands of the government in Iran, which is extremely xenophobic.
And how does that...
Well, it means that the opposition movement is labeled as a tool of the West, and the West is seen as exploitative and hegemonic over Iran and always trying to put Iran in a bad situation and in a subordinate situation. If the West says, we are with the opposition, then the government can say the opposition is anti-Iranian, they are traitors to the country, they are selling the country out. And so it's really incumbent on Western governments to be extremely careful about what they say. Obviously, all Western governments would like a democratic outcome to this. They would... there is widespread, not just in Iran, suspicion that the elections in June were rigged, and people would like an actual representative government to rule in Iran. But for the West to come out in strong support of the opposition movement would be counterproductive and, in fact, hurt the opposition movement.
But what they could do is press more on the issue of the nuclear on the nuclear issue. That was something they were working on before.
Well. It is very complex. For one thing, I do not think that the Iranians are pro-American. The Iranians are very nationalist.
Okay.
And they do not want, they have had enough trouble being whether under the old Russian Tsar influence or the British influence or American influence in the 60s. So they don't want to have anything to do with any of these powers in the world. What they want is just it's a democratic movement. It's a domestic movement. People want to deal with their own government and their problem. Now, what if the West, or particularly the United States or England, go in support of it? During the Bush era, they put $170 million to support the anti-regime movement. That actually turns into opposite of itself, because the government, as Dr. Davis said, will say, well, this is anti-West. And some people may buy that. And it would provoke the regime to pressure people. Now, the nuclear issue is a completely different thing.
Right.
For one thing, I do not think that whether the American state government or the British or Europeans are so interested about the democratic regime in Iran. What they want is their own interest, and their interest is to maintain some kind of stability, of course, in their own favor in Iran, and the issue of nuclear things is important for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what could be a wise choice for the U.S. policy would be to, as it pursues its own interest, to hang on to the issue of human rights, not to forget the human rights, because a state in Iran which does not respect human rights would be a totally violent state. It would be one that could go on all sorts of adventurous moves in the area, and of course would be completely destabilizing. Unfortunately, during previous administration in the U.S. and partially in the present time, there are groups that are pressuring Iran, the government of the United States, go only on the nuclear issue and not deal with the human rights. If the tying of the two together would be the wiser thing from the United States, but also probably works out better for the Iranian movement as well.
What about sanctions?
Well, sanctions haven't worked so far. The economy of Iran, and Professor Behdad will know more about this than I do because he's a professor of economics and knows Iranian economics extremely well, but the economy in Iran is not in a very good way, and that is partly because of Western sanctions. However, the government is surviving and the government is keeping going, and I think it's likely to keep going for the foreseeable future, sanctions or no sanctions. I don't know whether sanctions actually have much effect
on the government. They can hurt the people, though.
Well, the theory of sanction is that you put pressure, economic pressure, this economic coercion, on the country so that the people will suffer. And once the people will suffer, they will exert pressure on the government, and the government changes its course. Well, how much more pressure do you want from people on in Iran than it already exists? What will happen if you do a sanction? There already is some sanction, but if you intensify it, for example, they want to do it with respect to gasoline, etc., which is going to be catastrophic for Iran. It will increase the price of everything, and inflation is going to be higher. It will not get any more people into the street as they already are, and they have no other means than coming into the street. But what it's going to do is first gives the government a propaganda thing and say you are suffering because of the American sanction. And two, the black market. Now, this is the important part of the Iranian regime. There is a lot of economic power for Revolutionary Guard, and there are a lot of things that they own. There are a lot of income that they have. There's all off budget. Nobody knows how much it is and how huge it is. Now, the black market is in control of the Revolutionary Guard. You put more sanctions, there will be more black market, there will be more gains for them. They will love it.
Okay, well, let's take a quick break right now. We're talking about the protests in Iran. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Many musicians and music fans, including those of us at Fresh Air, are mourning the death of songwriter and singer Vic Chestnut. He died Christmas Day at the age of 45. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with friends and musicians who worked with him, guitarist Guy Picciotto, Michael Stipe of REM, and producer Jem Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Catch ArtZine, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artzine. On this month's show, go behind the scenes at Ballet Met's The Nutcracker. See the art of quilts at the newest exhibition at the Rife Gallery, and get to know the artists of soul art from the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. ArtZine gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus, online at wosu.org/artzine. 21 degrees with some light snow falling in central Ohio. We are under a winter weather advisory until 6 o'clock Friday morning. More snow developing this afternoon, an accumulation of 2 to 4 inches. And then more snow tonight, another 1 to 2 inches, giving us a total snow accumulation for the day of 3 to 5 inches, and a low tonight of 17. Cloudy for Friday with a slight chance of a few snow flurries and a high of 25. All Sides continues on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the protest in Iran and the revolution in Iran, such as it is, and what we know of it via social media. That's sort of what inspired me to call for this show in the first place. Is it's access to the country that we've really never had before, and I was wondering how that changes the dynamics of this revolution when there's so much access just to average Joe American has so much more access to what's actually going on there than they ever did in 1979 when they took the hostages and there was a whole different sentiment about the country. And Sohrab Dad, you were talking about that is a difference.
Yes, it is very important that the American public sees what happens in Iran because through the past years, calling Iran one of the axes of evil by President Bush, that would put Iran and the Iranians in a very peculiar position. And there was a sort of antagonism or subtle antagonism and sometimes express antagonism among American people toward Iran and Iranians. Now, however, when we look and see the Iranians are fighting a regime that they consider it itself a belligerent regime toward its own people, not only toward other countries and other groups, so they would have more sympathy for Iranian position and position of Iranian people. So I think it's very positive the American public sees what goes on in Iran, and the image of Iran, Iranians and Iran will hopefully change among Americans who consider Iranians as part of the evil, which is constituted the axis of evil. There's no axis of evil. There is no evil among Iranians. Iranians are fine people. They are very refined people. They understand the good things in life, and they like to have the good things in life, and they're fighting their own government for it. And what they want is no intervention by American state government in the case of Iran. And the whole issue of bombing Iran, and all that is just the things that would strengthen the regime and subdue the movement.
Bahram, Facebook and YouTube technically have been banned in Iran now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sense? I mean, does that mean that people aren't seeing it anymore, or they're
not supposed to
look at it? Right. Let's clarify. What does that mean? And
we have a lot of actually way so to see the YouTuber kind of actually connection to upload the image in YouTube. We have generally kind of filter and kind of abandon and kind of forbidden for using YouTube, Twitter, and this kind of stuff. But this is internet, this is a computer, and this is a media. So you can find a way. You can find a way so easily, and there is a lot of way to upload and transmit these kind of impersonal news to other parts of world and in internet.
I should remind the listeners and repeat that we're not using Bahram's real name. He's an OSU student, and we appreciate you being on the show today. We're not using your name. We want to protect your identity and keep you very safe. So you can come back again sometime.
sure.
Universities. Before we move on, I wanted to talk about the universities being shut down in 1979 or 1981.
Yep.
But before we do that, I did want to go back to the June 19th event when Neda Soltan was shot to death by security forces during a protest against the Iranian presidential election. Let's hear that.
Her name is Neda. The facts surrounding her life and her death difficult to verify. She appears to have been a young student who joined thousands of her countrymen to voice her disapproval of Iran's election results. Eyewitnesses say Basij militiaman hiding on a building rooftop shot Neda in her chest, silencing her forever. A man who appears to be her father, desperately calling on her to open her eyes. A stranger begging her to stay awake. Don't be afraid, don't be afraid, Neda, the man says. But Neda doesn't respond. She dies right there on the streets, another protester capturing her last moments on a cell phone camera. Octavia Nasser, CNN, reporting.
That was CNN reporting again. Neda Agha Soltan was shot to death on June 20th, 2009 by security forces. It was during a protest against the Iranian presidential election, and it was probably the single greatest PR moment of the revolution, at least up till that point. And I don't think there's really been anything like that since, has there, as far as riveting people?
Yes, there have been several other cases.
There have, but there was something about her death.
Well, yes, it was very. It was captured on a video, on a cell phone video, and it was distributed immediately. And people saw her face as she just was alive, and she just died. And so this is it's really hurtful to watch that. But there have been others as well. In fact, it's interesting. The next one in line that came out to have an impact was Sohrab Arabi, the second one. And actually, these two people, they were very young.
Was this the person who was crushed?
No. Okay. This was another person who was captured and then was killed in prison.
Okay.
Under torture. But these two have very, of course, they were young, beautiful. educated, and their names are also very important. Mm-hmm. Neda in Persian means the voice, a voice which is the sometimes is used as a voice of the people, as a voice of humanity, as even voice of God, revelation. So it was there. The next one is Sohrab. Sohrab, of course, here we have the expert on Shahnameh. And, of course, since it's my name, I can talk about it, too. Sohrab is a mythical character who is killed by his father. And so it is the term in Iran came out to be, this is the regime of Sohrab Kushi, means killing of Sohrabs. The father, that is the regime, is killing its own people. So this, in a symbolic way, of course, the visions, the pictures of Sohrab, who had many, several pictures right before the demonstration with the green things and all that, affected people very deeply and widely. But also the names are just in a very accidental way had some important impact. That's true. Agree?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
The protests are student-led, student-instigated. Back in the early 80s, they closed the universities for 3 years to
cultural
flush
revolution.
Away. It was a cultural revolution to flush away any memory of it. And
they flushed me away.
They flushed you away as one of the flushed. How well did it work? And what do you see? Is there a prospect for that this time?
At that time, they did the cultural revolution to close universities because they had absolutely no hegemonic power within the universities. Universities were all on the nearly all were on the left, and they were not Islamic in their way. There was an Islamic group, which was a Mujahideen group, which was in opposition to them. So they had to close it because they had no power, and they were the center of opposition. Now they are calling for one. They have no chance. They have no chance. At that time, they had the popular support, and they invaded university. They took over university. They beat up on heads and all that. But now they cannot do it. They have no chance.
Why is that? I mean, why can't they?
Because they don't have the popular support for doing it. They could bring the military. They can do what the Shah did. This is not. They were not the first one who closed the Iranian university. Iranian university has been the center of political opposition. And a year before the revolution, the whole year before it, nearly all the universities, particularly Tehran University, Sharif University, Polytechnic University, they were all closed and they were encircled by soldiers. So we didn't have classes a year before the revolution. And the revolution actually opened the schools. Opened the universities, and the students came into it, and some from prisons and some from the streets. And we conducted business for about a year until they closed us.
We had an email from a listener. I don't have it up right now. Okay, here it is. Wants to know, what is the status of education for children in Iran? Please break it out by gender. I don't know if you can do that or not. But if we look at many cultures like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, et cetera, we see low rates of female education. Yet I think it was you, Sohrab.
I am telling you, the number of actually girls going to university in these days, I'm talking with you, is more than boys.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so women outnumber men.
Yeah, more
and
than boys.
And their face is very familiar in this uprising, in these protests, much more so than it was in any of the other two, 99 or 79.
Sure. Yep.
How does that change the dynamic for you? I mean, does it matter? This is what you've kind of grown
up
with.
For sure not. This is a kind of actually a movement for all of us. We are equal and we have these rights to take care of our demand and goal. And this is equal for any girls and boys. They want and they have right to actually follow what they want. And this is doesn't matter for boys or girls. I think it's very, very good. And in this matter, it's not comparable with some kind of countries around us.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure about that.
No, actually, the rate of education in Iran, the rate of education of women, actually, I was doing a paper on this issue recently.
So you do know.
Yeah. Okay. The rate of education for Iran has been increasing since 1950s and a very strong slope. It slowed down, contrary to some perceptions, in between 1979 and 1985, but then it went back up. So the rate of education at different ages is quite quite high, and is comparable to and favorably comparable to many other countries. We have to note that the Iranian women are very strong. They fought this regime for the last 20 years. Not the first 10 years, they couldn't do it because of a strong oppression, but in the last 20 years, they have been fighting. They have been fighting on every street corner, on every aspect of social, political, and cultural life. And they are the ones who have been the target of the pressure, because the issue of women for Islamic regimes is a peculiar
one.
So they do. But we have to note that the unemployment rate among Iranian women of age 15 to 24 is about between 45 to 50%. That is, for those who come to the labor market to work, there are 50% cannot find jobs. And that is another source of the difficulty of women, because there is open discrimination in many aspects of work, especially for working women, for laboring class women, because they demand at that level to have separation of workspace, and you cannot, in a factory level, it's almost impossible to do that. And therefore, the factory women have lost their jobs, and many other positions, they have lost their jobs.
If I could add something to that, despite the discriminatory laws within the Islamic Republic against women, which are quite strong, and the, in theory, second-class status of women in Iran in many fields, obviously what Bahram and Sohrab have been saying about education of women is true. There are more women in America, in Iranian universities than there are men. But I would also say that women, in fact, have an extremely strong presence in Iranian cultural life, much stronger perhaps than people in the West realize. The only Iranian ever to win a Nobel Prize was a woman, Shirin Ebadi, the legal human rights expert. And also, most of the most famous novelists in Iran at the moment, and the novel is one of the few ways in which cultural and political and social protests can actually get out there. Most of the most famous novelists in Iran are women, and they have a huge following insofar as novelists anywhere have a following. So women, despite their, in theory, legal lower status, which is actually enshrined in the Constitution, despite that, they do have an extremely strong presence in Iran, and their voice and their sentiment for change is very strongly felt.
I wonder where that comes from. Why the difference? Why the higher rate of education? What since the 1950s? Is it a Western influence back
no.
from? Okay,
No. I don't think it's a Western influence at all. I'm on this panel about on sufferance, as it were, because really I'm a medievalist, so I'm somebody who looks back into the sort
we
of,
forced you on anyway.
I'm somebody who always looks for modern cultural things in terms of the ancient.
Well,
things.
Well, that's what I'm kind from. Of asking about is where there must be something.
And in fact, if you look at early Iranian literature, it's full of these extraordinarily strong women. These women who sort of get up and do things and make the world work the way they want it to make it. They want the world to work, and it's very common in early Persian literature, and those stories are taken from pre-Islamic literature. So the roots of this kind of strong, dominant, active, socially conscious, we're going to change the world and we're going to make it a better place. Feminine presence in Iranian culture is a very ancient one. It's gone underground for many times over the centuries, but it always reemerges. It reemerged at the time of the Constitutional Revolution, mm-hmm. in fact. Women were very important in the Constitutional Revolution in the late 1890s and early 1900s, and that was a shock to everybody. Suddenly these Islamic women who are supposed to be completely silent and uneducated out there doing things, and it's been so throughout the 20th century. So the presence of women's voice in Iranian culture has always been a strong one, despite the legal disabilities which are there.
There are more women in the College of Engineering in Iran than you could possibly ever find in any American university.
Yes. In fact, that's a topic of another symposium, I think, next week at OSU. It's trying to get more women in engineering. It's an interesting contrast, that's for sure. And it's interesting to hear you, and I'm so glad you have your medieval background. It's just, I knew it would come in handy somehow. We have an email from a listener. They write, "I'm excited to see these events. I don't think the American public is very aware of what may happen soon in Iran. If the current government is taken out, along with its obsessive enmity toward the USA, there will be a huge shift in perceived relations between the USA and Islam. Iran's young population cannot be kept ignorant, and their collective will cannot be denied. So that sounds like somebody that might be from Iran. I don't know. What does it sound like?
Yes, perhaps. I would say that this person's email seems to reflect this optimism which is floating around the West at the moment that there is going to be a change of regime in Iran. And it is possible. I mean, it's more likely now than at any time in the past 30 years, I think, since the Islamic Republic was founded. But I still think the odds are against it. The power is really in the hands of the government at the moment. The opposition is very fragmented. Different parts of the opposition want very different things. The Shah fell finally because, for him, it just wasn't worth it. He decided he was not going to have huge massacres on the streets. He may not have been able to. The army may have refused to do it, but he didn't order it. I think this government would order it. And if they did, they would hang on to power. I think it's unlikely there's going to be a shift of government soon.
So, Rob?
Yeah, there is another, of course, not the determining factor, but the important factor to consider. The Shah's regime, when it saw declining and falling, those who were in a position of power, they had some place to go.
This is an important point.
They came to California. They came to the United States as old generals, as old members of the secret police, etc. Where are these people going? They have no place to go. They can go to Syria. They can go to Russia. They can possibly go to China. I don't know. But they have no place to go. And they have a whole lot of, huge amount of interest. Financial interests. They are very wealthy. They have become very wealthy over the past 20 years. They have huge interests, the economic interests. They are fighting to the last moment for it.
Well, so did the Shah.
But the Shah's money was elsewhere.
It was movable. It was transportable.
And he could go anywhere that he wanted. Of course, he got difficulty later on. But the members of the regime, it's not just the Shah, the members of the regime, all those generals who were defining things, they had some place to go. So when General Huizer came and negotiated with them to pull out, they pulled out. They had some place to go. They're all in California. They were in California. Many of them are dead now.
It's true. There's no other Shia Islamic government in the world, certainly not 12 Shia Islamic government, which the Iranian government. The Iranian elite at the moment, the governing elite, has no ideological allies anywhere in the world. There isn't a place for them to run to. And when people can't run anywhere, then they hunker down. And I think that's what the regime is doing.
And I wanted to mention one thing that in this time, I don't have any idea about the future, what's happened for this movement. But for this time, the goal of people, something I understand, is not take over or change the regime. They want just correct them. They have very, very bad experience about 79 revolution. If they change everything, they destroy everything, then they should pay more about that. They want just correct. And they first start just tell actually government, where is my what? That's it. So they want something. Even actually the opposition leader says in these days they want some kind of couple of they have kind of note every, for example, week or months about some kind of declare what they want. They want just correct these people. Just take care of actually vote and people demand.
Most of them don't want revolution, but revolution is not.
They want
doesn't
change.
Come. No, but the revolution does not come by order. Revolutions happen.
See,
what happens is
I do
Iran, we get into a revolution even though its people may not want it.
Okay, we're running out of time. So, Rob Bedad, thank you for being here today. And Richard Davis, thank you so much. And Bahram, thank you very much for being here. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820. Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.